Wing Commander Pagery 1. When the war started, can you tell me which squadron you were serving with and in what capacity and what your reaction was, please?
When the war started, I was in fact still a student at London University, where I had learned to fly with the University Air Squadron. We were immediately called up, and I personally was sent to Cranmore, the Royal Air Force College, to polish up my flying training before being posted to a fighter squadron.
What had been your reaction to the outbreak of war?
Well, when you're 19 years of age, I couldn't wait for it to start, which obviously a great number of people wouldn't agree with that point of view, but if you're young and hot-blooded and you can fly an aeroplane, you want to get at the enemy, if that's the right expression.
Did you know much about the Luftwaffe before the war?
Not really, no. It was quite obvious at least 1 year that a war was... the war clouds were blowing up on the horizon, and as I say, we couldn't wait to start.
So you didn't have any conception of their strength in relation to the RAF?
No, nothing. Obviously, we followed the attacks on Poland and that sort of thing, and then later on the Low Countries. I got involved in, I think it was June 1940, our squadron was sent over to try and help the evacuation from Dunkirk, despite the fact that the army said, where were the RAF? The answer is quite simple. If we'd been over the beaches where the soldiers could see us, we wouldn't have been doing our job, because you've got to intercept the enemy before he gets the target. So we were out of sight, and also the Hurricanes, because Spitfires weren't allowed to go over France for security purposes, the Hurricanes, we only had about 20 minutes of fighting fuel after we'd crossed the channel and stayed around the area. And then we had to come back.
Which squadron were you with?
56. We were based at a place called North Weald, just near the Epping Forest, in 11 Group, which was the main fighting group, both at Dunkirk time and, of course, during the Battle of Britain.
What was the base at North Weald like?
It was a peacetime RAF aerodrome. Very few, if any, RAF airfields in those days had concrete runways. It was just a grass airfield with a permanent officers' mess and married quarters and those sort of things for all ranks. It was, as I say, a regular peacetime base, not just a wartime arrangement of huts and things like that.
What was the leadership of the squadron like at that time?
We didn't have a squadron commander. He'd been killed because half the squadron had gone to France and been based in France until the sort of Dunkirk evacuation time. And I don't know whether it was bad administration of the Air Ministry, but we never, in fact, during the time I was with the squadron until I was shot down, we didn't get a replacement CO until the last couple of weeks. So one of the flight commanders would lead the squadron, but that worked very well. Yeah, so morale was high, we were young, enthusiastic, nice aeroplanes, no fundamental problem.
And you were flying Spitfires, you say?
No, Hurricanes. I had been in the Spitfire squadron prior to June, but again, an administrative error. I'd been posted to number 66 Fighter Squadron, up in Norfolk, and about a month after I'd been there flying these Spitfires, they found there was a typist error, and I should have been posted to number 56 Squadron further south, flying Hurricanes. So when they found out the error, I was taken off Spitfires and sent down to fly Hurricanes. So I was lucky, because I had the unique experience being one of the very few pilots during the Battle of Britain who had flown both the Hurricane and the Spitfire.
How did the two aircraft compare to fly?
I'm often asked that question. I tend to give an example of the bulldog and the greyhound, the hurricane being the bulldog and the greyhound being the Spitfire. One's a sort of tough working animal and the other one's a sleek, fast dog, but I think their characteristics were comparable to the dog world.
Was there any difference between them in the ease of flying or the difficulty of flying?
No, not really. If anything, the Hurricane was slightly easier. It wasn't as fast and didn't have the rate of climb, but during the actual Battle of Britain itself, what really evolved was that the Hurricanes would attack the German bomber formations and the Spitfires, because of their extra capability of climbing, they would go up and attack the German fighter escorts. But in the earlier stages, I found that we were getting involved both with bombers and fighters when we were flying Hurricanes.
Did you have any preference for the one of the two?
No, they were both lovable because in their different ways they were delightful aeroplanes and both had the same Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. No, I wouldn't say that. Later on, after I came out of hospital, I went back flying Spitfires and continued on those for most of the war, with the exception of flying the American Mustang for a while.
When you flew over Dunkirk, what typically would an operation over Dunkirk be like?
It was in two main categories. One was that we would do a fighter sweep, that is, we'd go over one or two squadrons together, we would sweep all the way round behind the beaches and try and intercept any German aircraft coming to attack the soldiers on the ground. That was one role. And the other role was we would escort a bomber called the Blenheim and be their fighter escort when they went to bomb targets that were related to the evacuation from Dunkirk.
When you say a sweep, did you just fly in a kind of semicircle in the
hinterland? Well, we'd take off, cross out of England, cross in over France, probably somewhere in the Dunkirk area, further north along the coast, all the way around the back of Dunkirk, and then come out further south in the sort of Calais area, and then come back to England. But I say our shortage of fuel wouldn't permit us to really stay there very long.
You mentioned the criticism of the army towards the RAF over Dunkirk. Did you personally run into conflicts with soldiers?
Not personally, no, but I think our ground crews were the people who got into more fisticuffs in local pubs and taverns, because after a few beers the soldiers would say, where were you? And our ground crews knew very well that we'd gone off there. Imagine yourself being a soldier and dive-bombed and machine-gunned on the ground, and there's no RAF around that you can see personally. You don't realise they're probably 30, 40, 50 miles away trying to stop the Luftwaffe getting at you, but the man on the ground isn't aware of that, and he automatically is very bitter and twisted about the fact he's not being looked after.
How well prepared for combat did you feel that you were?
Not very much. One learnt the hard way. When I was at Cranmel after the University Air Squadron, we did a little dive bombing and air firing, but it wasn't really as good as it should have been. And as I say, you learnt the hard way. You saw an aeroplane with an iron cross marked on the side of it, and you attacked it, and through experience you learnt to hit it more often later on than miss it, as you did at the beginning.
Because did they not have standard methods of attack which they tried to give you?
The RAF had pre-war standard methods of attack which time proved were ineffectual, and later on in the war we copied the German tactics which they had developed probably during the Spanish Civil War, and they were ahead of us in the way they flew their fighter formations. But one learns quickly, and for example the basic formation in 1940 was three aircraft. Well, learning from the Germans, we realized that your basic unit is two aircraft and not three, and a formation is eventually developed called a finger four, which if you stretch out your hand with your fingers splayed, forgetting the thumb, you will see that those are the relative positions of the fingertips, the way we flew our aircraft.
Can you describe any specific incidents which you were personally engaged in over the Dunkirk area?
Yes, there was one where we intercepted a formation of German fighters with the Stuka Ju-87 dive bomber. The Stuka was an easy target. The only trouble was when they went into a dive, they were so slow, and you followed them down with your Hurricane, you caught them up so rapidly that you only had a very short time, literally 1 or 2 seconds, to fire at them, because you were accelerating so rapidly at the dive that you'd go past them. But in fact, the Germans withdrew the Stuka from the Battle of Britain because they were just decimated.
What happened in that incident?
Well, the Messerschmitt 109 fighters came down on us, of course, to help their Stukas, and it was quite funny because I was running out of fuel, and touch and go as to whether I would get back to England. So, because when you get into a fight, obviously you're putting on much more engine power and your fuel consumption really shoots up. So there came a point where you headed back for home. Otherwise, if you stayed around any longer, you weren't going to get home. So I levelled out just a few feet over the sea and streaked towards Dover with two Messerschmitts chasing me. But I think they too probably had a fuel problem because they left me alone after a while. But the next enemy was when I got near Dover Harbour. The Royal Navy started opening fire on me, thinking I was attacking incoming aircraft. But I managed to avoid that one, and all ended happily.
Did you get a view of what the beaches looked like at Dunkirk?
Oh, very much so. I mean, looked like masses of ants on this large sand dune area. One felt desperately sorry for the troops down below. I think it's important to remember that Dunkirk was not a glorious victory as far as the army was concerned. I feel it was a glorious victory for the Royal Navy, the way they got so many troops off, and I think it was also a glorious achievement for the people in the little boats. But let's face it, the army were in full retreat, and they were relying on the Navy and the RAF and the little boats to get them off.
Were you shocked at what you saw of Dunkirk, or did you know what the desperate military situation was?
We had a glimmer of the military situation, but we weren't really kept that informed as a fighter unit. Our lives consisted of sleeping as much as we could, because there was a great shortage of that. And then we would just say, well, tomorrow morning, first light, you're off on a fighter sweep or to escort the bombers in certain areas. But on the subject of Dunkirk, I must say I was very gratified, because having seen this ghastly retreat, years later I was to command a Spitfire squadron on D-Day, and I was over the beaches at first light, and it was a tremendous thrill to see all the Allied troops, and particularly our own, of course, going in over the beaches as we flew up and down trying to give protection if they were attacked from the air, which they weren't.
You said that morale was high at this time in your squadron. Did it remain high during the Dunkirk period?
Oh, yes, very much. I don't think at any point it was low. I left suddenly, of course, one day in August when I was shot down, but morale was tremendous because the facts of life were we'd be flying many, many times during the day, having taken off in the darkness, and then as the dawn came up, we'd fly to a forward base such as Manston or Hawkinge or Rochford, which is now Southend Airport, and then we'd be at Redness all through the day, and then in the evening, just as the light was beginning to fail, we'd fly back to our base at North Weald, and then there'd be a mad rush to get down to the local tavern and before the pubs closed. Don't forget, we were all 19, 20, 21 years of age. We were just overgrown schoolboys. And then some idiot, as the pub closed, would say, well, let's go up to London and go to a nightclub. So we'd career up to London in a couple of rather rickety cars, and then come back and maybe grab an hour's sleep, and then we were off again before first light in the morning. So I suppose the lack of sleep, in a way, was a self-inflicted wound in the early parts. Later on, of course, we were desperately short of sleep and fatigue.
Which nightclubs would you go to?
The one that sort of whose name seems to linger in my mind was called the Bag of Nails, just off Regent Street. It was all innocent fun, but when you've had a hard day's flying and then you're not drinking that much, but there were some pretty young hostesses. Not that ever led to anything, because you had to get back to the airfield. But it was just schoolboy enthusiasm and mirth, I think, is how we would describe it.
So your superior officers didn't put a stop to this type of thing?
No. In fact, quite often they were with us. We had a delightful station commander, an Irishman, called Victor Beamish, of the famous Beamish rugby family. He never came up to London. He was an old man, as far as we were concerned. I think he was 30, but he was adored by everybody, and sadly killed later, because he used to come and fly with us, although he was theoretically just the station commander and not really supposed to be flying in the air at all, but he'd come every time he could. But it caught up with him.
Did you fly under the influence of alcohol?
Never, no. I never witnessed an occasion where anybody took a drink before flying. It didn't mean that perhaps there was alcohol in our bloodstream from the night before. I don't know how we would face up to today's breathalyzer, but no.
How many times do you think that you operated over the Dunkirk area?
Oh, probably a dozen times, I suppose. It all folded pretty quickly, and we'd go about twice a day, but memory is fickle. I wouldn't like to swear by those figures. But don't forget, of course, there were lots of other squadrons doing the same thing, and we were trying to give a constant support.
How many German planes do you think you shot down over Dunkirk?
I think the answer is probably nil.
Was the 109 a feared plane?
Highly respected, not feared. An aeroplane that came later on in the war, which was the Focke-Wulf 190, one didn't fear that either, but one respected that even more because of its tremendous maneuverability and other features which you appreciate in a fighter aircraft.
Did the German pilots seem to be more experienced than the RAF pilots?
Difficult to answer that one. I think undoubtedly those people like Adolf Galland and a certain nucleus who'd fought in Spain. Obviously they had experience. I think where the Germans probably got a shock was when they attacked Poland and the Low Countries, Belgium and Holland. They only got token resistance from rather antiquated aircraft. And then at the time of Dunkirk and certainly Battle of Britain, they suddenly came up against an air force with sophisticated equipment, and I think we could say we were highly disciplined as an air force, and the Royal Air Force. So we never looked on the Germans as being superior to ourselves, except in numbers.
After Dunkirk and before the Battle of Britain, in the intervening period, what were you doing?
There wasn't much of an intervening period, really, because you'd have to check the dates, but Dunkirk, I think, was June, and the Battle of Britain officially started on about July 12th, 13th, when they commenced to attack the shipping convoys that were going up through the Strait of Dover. So you're only talking about two or three weeks. And we'd get, we still had to do full readiness. We'd get early morning weather reconnaissance aircraft flying out from France for the Germans to ascertain what the weather conditions would be for attacks. We were not idle.
Who do you remember who served with you in 56 Squadron? Who were your friends?
There were several of them. There was a delightful man called Barry Sutton. He'd been a pre-war journalist, and another excellent flight sergeant pilot called Taffy Higginson, who's as Welsh as you can be, hence his name Taffy.
Higginson,
yes. Mm-hmm. And there were several others. But we were all friends. There was no... although, as you probably are aware, in all squadrons, fighter or bomber, during the war, there were commissioned officers and there were non-commissioned officers of sergeant rank. While we were lying around our aircraft or in the air, there was no differentiation between rank at all. I always felt it was a little unfair that after a hard day's fighting and you landed, and one lot of us, the commissioned officers, we would go off to the officers' mess and the sergeants would go off to the sergeants' mess. I think men who take an equal risk should live the same way, but that's just a personal view.
How did the Battle of Britain begin for you personally?
My first fight was, we'd taken off from North Wheel, gone to Manston Airfield, which is quite close to Ramsgate and Margate, right down the southeast tip of Kent. And we were sent off, six of us, and normally the telephone would ring and you were told to scramble, six of us being half a squadron or a flight. And as we climbed up, we received our instructions from the controller, who advised us that there were about 20 bombers coming in to attack a convoy, and that there were about 60 fighters up above them acting as fighter escort. So our leader, who was a flight lieutenant called Gracie, he ordered Taffy Higginson to take three aircraft down and attack the bombers, and the other three of us, we climbed up to attack the 60 escorting fighters. I suppose with hindsight, I should have been scared stupid, but I think I was so busy getting my aircraft ready, for example, making sure the camera gun was switched on, making sure the safety button on the machine guns was on fire and not on safety, and generally trimming up the aeroplane for the approaching combat. And then suddenly there was this enormous swarm of aircraft above us as we were climbing up. And this, of course, is always dangerous when you're defending a place. You're always climbing to intercept, and your speed is low, whereas the attacker, he's way up in the sky, and he's flying quite fast and has a tremendous advantage over you. Anyway, we got up, and there were two types of aeroplanes, both fighters. One was a twin-engine fighter called the Messerschmitt 110, and the other was a single-engine Messerschmitt 109. And I had a quiet chuckle to myself, despite my mouth feeling rather dry with fear, that the twin-engine Messerschmitt 110s went into a defensive circle to protect themselves from the attack from these three Hurricanes. And I dived into this circle, firing rather wildly and through absolute inexperience. And then the 109s came down on us. And then this phenomenon, which I saw again and again and again throughout the war, when you have a dogfight, so many aeroplanes, and then suddenly it's as if the hand of God has wiped the slate clean and there's nothing else in the sky. And I suddenly found myself alone, except for in the distance there was one speck of an aeroplane circling, and he was turning towards me, and we approached each other head on, and then I realized that it was a Messerschmitt 109. So we did the equivalent of tilting at the lists in medieval times. We just attacked each other head on. I could see the little white dots on the leading edge of his wing as he fired. I was feeling a bit stubborn that morning, so I didn't budge. Anyway, he flashed over the top of me, and I returned to base, landed, and one of our pilots had been shot down, but not injured. And I was asked if I'd shot anything down. I said no, I may have hit him. And then 17 years later, a man who was writing a book showed me an article in a German newspaper of the 1940s, which showed a German pilot by the wreckage of his burnt-out Messerschmitt 109 in a field in northern France. And it was the same man, because he'd done some research and he'd found out my name and my squadron, and he described the head-on attack, and I got a confirmed victory 17 years later. It's recorded in a semi-official book called the Luftwaffe Diaries, that actual combat. So that was my first blooding, as it were.
Do you know the date of that, approximately?
I can't quote it out of my head, but it was July during the early phase, because these 20 bombers had in fact been attacking a shipping convoy.
Did you have any sense during the Battle of Britain that the fate of the country depended on you?
Never. I think we were so occupied with our daily task, and you must remember pre-war Royal Air Force, and I think probably all through the war, one never really discussed politics at all. It wasn't an issue. And by politics, I'm talking about international as opposed to national politics. Two subjects were taboo in the officers' mess. You never talked politics, and you never talked about the opposite sex. Well, we certainly never talked politics.
But